would be great to live longer, but who wants to live longer with Alzheimer's disease? So the great hope is that we're going to be able to eliminate these diseases and allow everyone to live a healthy, long lifespan.
Hello again and a very warm welcome to LAMA, the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. My name is Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. This episode is brought to you in association with Amazentis, a Swiss life science company that's pioneering cutting-edge, clinically validated cellular nutrition under its Timeline brand. Now, earlier this month, it was revealed by his family that one of the greatest singers of all time, Tony Bennett, has Alzheimer's disease, the most common form of age-related dementia. He is 94 years old now, and according to what I have to say is a very moving piece in the AARP magazine, he was diagnosed in 2016, and now some 5 years later, the article says, even his increasingly rare moments of clarity and awareness reveal the depths of his debility. Memory loss and a detachment from reality are typical of this brutal disease, a disease that I think most of us have probably experienced in some way, family members, friends, neighbours. It is on the increase and there is still no cure, which is why I, for one, devour every bit of new research in the hope that one day we will not have to fear what is often called the long goodbye. And talking of new research, there is a study underway that particularly caught my eye because it involves a compound that we on this podcast have discussed a lot over recent months. My guest is Dr. Julie Anderson, a researcher at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, just to the north of San Francisco, here in California. Dr. Anderson recently received a $3.1 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study the potential benefits of urolithin A as a possible treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Anderson, welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
It's really good to talk to you. We'll do a recap on what urolithin A is in a moment. But tell me about working at the Buck. I did an interview with Eric Verdin, the Institute's president, for this podcast shortly after he was appointed, and I still haven't managed to take him up on his offer to come and visit. Hopefully I will one day. But I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that if you're interested in aging and the science of aging, it's the place to be. It's the place to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful place. I've been there over 20 years now, and I'm really a neuroscientist, and I probably could have ended up in a neuroscience department or neurology school. But I have to say, I really love working at the Buck. It's still the only freestanding institute studying aging and age-related disease. And that really gives a breadth to the type of research that we do rather than studying diseases in silos independent from the aging process, really concentrated on what it is about aging itself that drives all these disparate diseases.
And I think one of the interesting things about the place is the multidisciplinary approach, that you're not just looking at aging from one perspective. And I think that's where a lot of the energy must come from in terms of working in those laboratories.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I have to say that when I first came to the Buck, there was another faculty member who happened to be a cancer biologist. And, you know, your first thought is, oh, that's the work is really interesting, but really, what does cancer have to do with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease? But it turns out that a lot of these basic aging mechanisms drive very different age-related diseases. And I think it's very exciting to work at the Buck in the sense that we're very collaborative and we kind of work across different fields at looking at these basic mechanisms that drive aging and age-related disease.
What first got you interested in aging?
I mean, I have to admit that when I was in college, I started to develop an interest in studying the brain, so neuroscience. And it just happened that the laboratory that I ended up in at UCLA for my graduate studies, and I think things often in life are fortuitous this way, it happened to be a lab that was studying Parkinson's disease. And when I went on to my postdoctoral fellowship at Mass General Hospital in Boston, I really was targeting labs that were studying Parkinson's disease. And to some degree, fortuitously again, when I was looking for my first faculty position, I was hired by the School of Gerontology at USC. And I think that that was really what opened my eyes to this notion, which is now very widely accepted, this idea of geroscience, which is that there are basic mechanisms which occur in almost every cell in the body that are involved in driving aging in like many, many, many different organs and tissues. So my time at Andrus Gerontology really got me started thinking about aging and how it relates to diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. And then I moved to the Buck in 2000, and that's just been a wonderful experience for me.
And I think what's interesting, and you have probably a much better perspective on this than I do, that in terms of the respectability of studying aging as a discipline, how that has changed over the decades. And I think there was, certainly from talking to other scientists on this podcast, to get a sense that a few decades ago, if you said you were studying aging, it wouldn't necessarily be taken that seriously, because it isn't biochemistry, it isn't physics, it isn't mathematics. It is, I suppose, a combination of all of those things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think in the nascent years of biology of aging research, because we knew so little about it, I think there was a lot of skepticism and a lot of concern about, I guess, what I would call the snake oil effect, that people were touting different therapeutics in terms of aging without really knowing enough about the process. But I think fast forwarding a decade or so, we really have been able to drill down on precise molecular mechanisms that are involved in aging. And having been in the field for 20 years, it's really like burgeoned over the last 5-10 years, and is taken very, very seriously. I think we're kind of in the renaissance, I would say, of aging research, which is wonderful. It's wonderful to be a part of that.
And with a better understanding of those mechanisms involved, does it help you produce a concise definition of what aging is? It's that, I suppose, that age-old question that so many people pose, and we still get very different answers in terms of what it is and what it entails, whether it's a disease itself or whether it's just an umbrella term to describe a number of diseases that affect us as we get older. What do you say to that question?
I mean, I think that that's very true. I think there is still a fair degree of controversy in the field about what the exact definition of aging is. The rubric that we at the Buck sort of operate under is this rubric of geroscience, which I have to say was a term which was coined at the Buck by Gordon Lithgow, who's a fellow faculty member and actually is my spouse. And it was part of a center grant that we got on diverse sort of integrative science. And he coined this term geroscience, which is sort of this overreaching idea that aging isn't just a risk factor for all of these different diseases, but it's actually the underlying driving force, and that we have the ability to define precise molecular mechanisms that are common amongst these different diseases that are acting to exacerbate and to propagate the diseases.
And for the audience of this podcast, I always try to dig beneath the jargon, or at least try to eliminate some of the jargon from the discussion. And one phrase, I don't know whether it's jargon or not, but one phrase, of course, that we all hear a lot is simply anti or anti-aging. I don't really know what anti-aging is. I consider personally myself that aging is still something that's moving forward, as opposed to something that is maybe stationary or could be even reversed and turned backwards. Is anti-aging, is it just a marketing term, do you think? And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
I think it's a term that a lot of people use. I mean, I have to admit, I'm a basic research scientist, so I probably err on the side of being more conservative. I'm not sure whether we'll find out as research progresses. I'm not sure whether we will be able to reverse aging. But, you know, to be honest, to be able to slow the process in the hopes that everybody's going to be able to, let's say, live to the age of 90 or above and not have major age-related diseases, I think that's what most scientists in the field are really, really hoping for. So to some extent, it's not, I mean, early in the biology of aging field, I think a lot of the emphasis was on longevity or increasing lifespan. And I think the emphasis has really sort of turned in the last several years towards health span. So the idea of, yeah, so it would be great to live longer, but who wants to live longer with Alzheimer's disease? So the great hope is that we're going to be able to eliminate these diseases and allow everyone to live a healthy, long lifespan.
Yeah, and I think that very neatly brings us around to what we are going to spend most of the time today talking about, that is research surrounding Alzheimer's. And certainly in recent months on this podcast, we've talked quite a lot and quite extensively about urolithin A, which is this compound derived from fruits, pomegranates in particular, which can play essential role in mitochondrial health, the energy centers of our cells. It can help maintain at least the processes and the mechanisms involved, can help us with our muscular strength, prevent frailty in old age, which is a crucial issue for anyone who is getting old. It's often the beginning of the end if frailty sets in and people succumb to falls and that kind of thing. So that's why muscular right. strength is important. But what I find now fascinating relating it to your work is the potential for some relationship with Alzheimer's. So let's start from the beginning. How did you first become aware of urolithin A and explain its significance?
Sure. So as I said, I'm a neuroscientist. So we study processes which allow the healthy maintenance of neurons in the brain. And one of those processes is something called autophagy. So autophagy is something that's undertaken by an organelle in the cell called the lysosome. You can kind of, just like the body has organs, the cell has organelles, the nucleus is the brain of the cell, mitochondria, which you mentioned are sort of the energy producing plants of the cell. Well, you have these other organelles called lysosomes that are important in terms of getting rid of defective proteins and also organelles that have become defective, like mitochondria. So these damaged cells, cellular components are are tagged and they're taken up into the lysosome and they're broken down into their component parts. I kind of think of the lysosome as being the recycling center of the cell. And those parts can then be reused to make new functional proteins and new functional organelles like mitochondria. So he had a lot of interest in this idea of protein turnover and turnover of defective mitochondria. And we were looking for compounds that were restoring lysosomal function and therefore producing functional proteins and functional mitochondria. And we'd actually been screening for drugs to look for compounds that fulfilled that function. And at that time, we happened to notice a paper, which was about 5 years ago from the Awards lab, where they had been looking at urolithin A. And what really intrigued us was that they were looking at UA in the context of both longevity. So they were looking in these little invertebrate models of aging called C. elegans, little worms that people use to study aging-related genes. And now a lot of studies are ongoing to look at compounds that extend lifespan in these worms. And it's pretty amazing because you think, what do we as human beings have in common with worms? But it turns out that a lot of the basic biological processes which drive longevity and aging are conserved evolutionary in these animals. So if you're screening these animals for a drug that increases longevity, it very well may increase longevity in mammalian species, including humans. And not only that, as I alluded to before, it can also increase health span by allowing the formation of new functional mitochondria. And in this paper, which was really exciting to us, the investigators looked at the ability of urolithin A in normal aging mice to improve, as I think you mentioned, muscle function. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, muscle function is very important. As you said, it's one of the things that often, even in relation to diseases like Parkinson's disease, it's the effects on being able to have appropriate muscle function that leads to falls and so forth that can have devastating effects in terms of people's, overall health. So we were very, very intrigued by that study and very interested in looking at the efficacy of urolithin in some of our animal models of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease.
And just before we continue, if you could maybe explain and recap for us the processes and the mechanisms involved. And I mentioned urolithin A and I mentioned pomegranates. The fruits are not exactly where we find the urolithin A. It's something that happens in our gut. Our gut metabolism is crucially involved. And we all respond in different ways to the elagitannins, as they're known, that are found in fruits. That's the beginning of the process. But we don't all necessarily then go on to generate urolithin A to the same degree.
Yes, precisely. And that is something that we're also very interested in terms of aging. So it turns out that you're absolutely correct. Urolithin A is not the component that's found within health foods like pomegranate or walnuts, what have you, but it's actually a precursor called alkylic acid. So alkylic acid within those foods, when we ingest them, it actually gets converted by bacteria in the gut to urolithin A. And it's urolithin A then in the gut and can enter the bloodstream and it can enter every organ in the body, including the brain. It's able to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain. It turns out with aging, we often have what's called gut dysbiosis or changes in the bacteria and other critters that are found within the gut, something called the gut microbiome with age. And the ability of the bacteria in our gut, because of the change in the composition, to convert compounds like lactic acid to urolithin A decreases because of this change in bacteria. So one of the things that we were interested in was whether part of the reason, or whether with older individuals, they may not be able to reap the full benefits of eating health foods like pomegranates because of this change in their gut microbiome. And if we could restore an older person's gut microbiome to that of a younger person, would that help them more easily convert the lactic acid in these foods into UA? Would that improve their ability to produce UA and have the beneficial effects of urolithin A?
Now, I mentioned we have talked about this before, and we've talked about it in relation to, and I mentioned again that this is a podcast in association with Amazentis, which is the Swiss company that has developed a highly pure form of urolithin A called MitoPure. And this is essentially a nutritional supplement. And for all the reasons that you have described in some detail as to why it is important that as we grow older, we have levels of urolithin A that can perhaps work for us on many different levels in terms of preventing some of those killer diseases, potentially, as we grow older. So I'm interested to know, how has the work of Amazentis, and there have been a number of clinical trials so far, how does that complement the work that you're doing?
Yeah, we were very excited to see their initial published clinical trial looking, in humans and looking at the efficacy in older humans of urolithin A to enhance muscle function. So normally in science, we run what are called preclinical trials where we look at, let's say, a compound in a mouse model of a disease or during the aging process, and that then moves to a human clinical trial where we're seeing whether the same holds in humans. So we were very excited to see that earlier findings from the Awarts group in mice, in aging mice, were replicated in the small clinical trial in humans. And actually, they went a step further and they were looking to look molecularly at the impact of urolithin in the muscles, whether that involved enhanced mitochondrial function. And the data from their study seemed to indicate, yes, that was the case. So it's very, very exciting when you see something that seems to work well in terms of preclinical basic science studies, that it can be moved into human populations, because honestly, that's why we all do research, and that's what we're wanting in the end, to be able to show a clinical effect in humans. So fantastic.
I think what a lot of this highlights is the increasingly understood importance of the microbiome.
Yeah, absolutely. We're part of the interest, to be honest, in urolithin in our study was part of a larger interest that the lab has in the role that the microbiome plays in diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. We used to think of these diseases as being brain centric, that all of the things that go wrong have to do with the neurons in the brain. But it actually turns out that it may very well be, for example, in the case of Parkinson's disease, the disease actually starts in the gut, that there are changes in the gut microbiome, which causes an increase in inflammation, which can affect the inflammation in the brain. You can have a change in the gut microbiome producing inflammatory factors that can then enter the bloodstream and enter the brain and cause inflammation in the brain and neurodegeneration. And you also can be affecting the production of different metabolites that we need that are produced in the gut and released into the circulatory system and cross the blood-brain barrier that are important for brain function. And unfortunately, with age, we tend to have fewer bacteria, but the diversity of the bacteria that we have decreases. So we don't really have all the needed bacteria to make all of the nutrients and to damp down inflammation, thereby affecting the brain. It's interesting because in Parkinson's patients, there's a subset of people who end up being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease that 20 years before the fact had all sorts of gastrointestinal issues, IBD and constipation and et cetera. And we're realizing that there's a real molecular link there due to changes in the gut microbiome that can then affect the brain. So it's kind of opened up this whole new area of study in science, and particularly in age-related disease, called the gut-brain axis, where some people call the gut like the mini brain, and it's been, in terms of CNS disorders, it's been implicated in autism and schizophrenia, and now there's a lot of data backing up this gut dysbiosis, change in the gut microbiome in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. So very, very interesting area that urolithin A is a very important part of.
Exactly. And I was actually just going to say, I think the challenge for a lot of people is probably just getting your head around the idea that something that you might have otherwise or previously thought of as being a brain disease or a brain-related disease, when we're especially talking about losing your memory, that it does relate in a very significant way to your gut and ultimately to what you eat.
Yes, absolutely. So it is, you know, we say you are what you eat. Absolutely. It's very, very important. And maintaining a healthy gut is very, very important in because you need to have a healthy gut in order to stop the production of these bad things that can get into the blood and get into the brain, these pro-inflammatory factors, and also to keep producing important metabolites like short-chain fatty acids that the brain needs to function. So there's absolutely a very strong connection between the two.
Now, just changing tack a little, I mentioned in the introduction that you have this $3.1 million, your laboratory has this grant to move forward with this research. First of all, I'm just curious, how do you get a grant like that? I think in the last 12 months, we've probably all become aware of the crucial importance of clinical trials, which you'll be well aware of are incredibly expensive to conduct. But how do you go about applying for and being awarded a sum of money like that?
Yeah, it is a somewhat laborious process. So someone like myself who does basic science, we are interested in molecular mechanisms. So part of our interest in urolithin is, of course, we're very, very interested in its efficacy to prevent diseases like Alzheimer's, but we're also interested in the underlying mechanisms, like what exactly is the compound doing that's so good for the brain? Because by understanding the mechanism, we may be able to come up with other drugs that do similar things and might do it more efficiently. So in the process of trying to get funding in order to do preclinical research, a large governmental agency, which is involved in funding basic research and clinical research in the U.S., is the National Institute of Health, or NIH. And so You write a grant asking the agency to fund the project you're interested in. It goes to what's called peer review. So it's a group of people who have expertise in the area, let's say expertise in autophagy or expertise in Alzheimer's disease, the grant with a number of other grants. I actually sit on a study section, and a study section that reviews grants meets about three times a year and goes over maybe 100 different grants. So you can see that there's a large volume of grants that come in asking for funding from the NIH. And in part of this peer review process, you receive a score. You're ranked with the other grants. And then the NIH is able to fund a subset of those grants. When I have to say, when funding was really dire for aging research, NIH was funding something like 5 to 7% of all grants, which is a pretty small percentage. So you put in a grant, you wait 5 or 6 months until the study section reviews it, you get a score, and then you wait another 5 or 6 months to find out whether the grant's going to be funded by the NIH. So there's a large period of time during the process where you're really, once you've submitted the grant, you're just waiting to find out whether or not you got funding. But the good news is if you get funding, normally funding's for 3 to 5 years, which is a good amount of time to allow you to explore your particular hypothesis, which in our case was that urolithin would be something that would prevent or improve Alzheimer's symptoms in a preclinical model. And that's a needed step in order for studies to be carried forward into clinical studies in humans. Things are first studied preclinically in, for example, mouse models of the disease, before they're allowed to be carried forward into humans, including studies on the safety of the compound. That all has to be done. So safety, how efficacious it is, et cetera, that's all done preclinically.
And you mentioned that funding traditionally for aging or age-related projects has been quite difficult to get. Is that changing? And I guess one of the problems must be, but by its very nature, aging is something that happens over a long period of time. And especially when you're talking about human trials, it's a little bit different with nematode worms or mice or fruit flies. But when you're talking about humans, if you want to see a cause and effect, it's going to have to be over quite a long period of time, which must make getting the funding for that over that period of time quite difficult.
Right, exactly. And I think that is something that makes the clinical trials in terms of aging per se difficult, because you are looking at people, or ideally you're looking at individuals over a longer period of time. So, I mean, I have to say, even so, my husband works on worms. Worms, the C. elegans, their lifespan is 2 weeks. So they're able to do studies when they're looking at lifespan or health span in that invertebrate organism. They're able to do those pretty rapidly. The average lifespan of a mouse is 3 years. If you're looking at something like, I don't know, childhood type 1 diabetes in a mouse, you can look at young mice and you can do it more rapidly. Average age of the mouse being 3 years. If you're looking at something like Alzheimer's disease, you're doing those studies over, let's say, 1, 2, 3 year period. So it's a little bit more elongated, depending on the preclinical species that you're using. And ideally, you want to use a species that's most like humans as possible. Some people use primates for studies in aging, but as you can imagine, their lifespan being 30 years and more, those are even more long-term studies. So yes, that is something inherent in funding both preclinically and clinically for aging research that has to be taken into consideration. The FDA actually traditionally doesn't really, if you're funded for a clinical trial, it's traditionally towards a particular disease as opposed to aging per se.
So as you move forward with this research, can you give me an idea of the stages in terms of looking ahead the next month, the next year, the next 3 years, in terms of the form of research that you'll be carrying out? What will you need to do?
To be honest, the first thing that we had to convince ourselves our hypothesis was that giving a mouse model of Alzheimer's disease, that it was going to slow the course or, you know, stop the course of or prevent the course of Alzheimer's disease in that mouse model. And we're kind of well into the middle of the study. These results are really preliminary, but we do have preliminary data that suggests that the Alzheimer's mice that have been placed, so we were actually giving urolithin in the feed. So the mice are taking it orally in the feed, just the same way that ellagic acid is, you know, given in food to humans. And our preliminary data says that this seems to be improving cognition or preventing the cognitive loss that you see associated with this mouse Alzheimer's model. So we're now in the process of actually looking at the brains from those mice. These mice, this particular mouse model that we're using, which is called a 3X AD transgenic, they actually produce the plaques and tangles within the brain that are very similar to what you see in humans. So we're in the process now of the mice seem to have improved cognition. Is that due to the fact that they're not producing the same plaques and tangles that we associate with Alzheimer's disease in humans? And so that's sort of the stage we're at now.
How do you measure the improved cognition in the mice?
Well, there are some very well established tests, which probably sound crazy to a lay audience, but there are some well established cognitive tests. One that's the most well established is something called the water maze or the Morris water maze, where basically you have a round, large tub of water, which is opaque. And you put a little submerged stand at a particular location in this tub of water, and you put the mouse in there, and you measure in time how long it takes it to find the platform. And so there's kind of a learning curve that goes along with that. That once, if you do that several times, the mouse will eventually learn kind of where the submerged platform is placed within the tub, and will go more directly to it. And then you can do an additional test where you move the platform someplace else and see how much time it takes the mouse to get to that platform. So that's one of and that is a test of function of a brain area called the hippocampus in the mouse, and it's the same area within humans that's impacted in Alzheimer's disease. So there's several tests like that which have been well established to look at particular brain regions and how they're functioning.
And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Hi, Denise Hamilton-Mace here, host of the Low No Drinker podcast, your place to go to meet the people and brands leading the low and no alcohol revolution. Every week, I speak to brand founders like Carl Anthony Brown from CrossFit Non-Alcoholic Spirits and ex-Master Chef finalist Billy Wright from Descent 10% Gin. Industry experts like Hamish Renton in our chat about how the fat jabs will impact low and no drinkers. And I help you answer questions like, what the heck is the difference between non-alcoholic and alcohol-free anyways? This podcast is for you if you're looking for a fun and informative way to explore a life less intoxicated with no judgment or expectation. Check out the link in the description or find me at lownodrinkermagazine.com.
It's interesting you say that. It reminds me of a job many, many, many moons ago. I used to work for the Medical Research Council in the UK, and I worked with Mamas et Monkeys. It was actually very similar to what you're saying. This is a laboratory looking at cognitive issues, schizophrenia, Parkinson's disease, and my job as laboratory technician at that stage was looking at the cognitive abilities of those monkeys that may be impaired in some ways and seeing how they responded to visual stimulus.
Yeah. I mean, part of this water maze is also visual because you have particular, like you might have particular posters or something on the walls, and part of what the mice are processing is the placement of that stimuli, and that helps direct them to where the platform is. So, I mean, It's kind of amazing to me, but these techniques for looking at cognition have been established over decades in mouse models.
It is, and when you're actually doing this work, it is enlightening just to a large extent, just seeing how the ability of an animal, whatever the species of animal is, its ability to learn and to remember, and what animals.
Yeah, it is.
A lot of people wouldn't think about a mouse and its cognitive abilities, but
right,
or other animals as well, but they exist in big time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, what's the next stage? You were just about to go on to the next stage in the research.
So, you know, we feel, again, it's preliminary. I'm a basic scientist, preliminary, and we need to repeat and be absolutely sure that the findings that we have are reproducible. But we can't help but be excited that we seem to be having effects. So sort of stage two of the process will be looking, so these are older mice. These are mice that are like 14 months. So they're sort of, I guess I would say middle-aged mice, so we'll continue to look with increasing age. And also, we want to start diving in more to this whole gut-brain axis. How much do age-related alterations in the gut, how much influence does this have in terms of cognition, especially with the giving the animals ellagic acid, the precursor. So in a sense, you can give urolithin A, which is the active compound, or an older person might be eating foods that have ellagic acid, or taking ellagic acid itself, and then also maybe taking a probiotic, so reestablishing a healthy microbiome, and would that be sufficient to raise levels of urolithin A within the older individual to what would be therapeutic levels that would help maintain cognition with age. Very much interested in this microbiome angle.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Of course, you're not doing this kind of research in isolation. We've mentioned the work of Amazentis in Switzerland as well, which is still ongoing. This is, in many senses, a collaborative effort, isn't it, to try to better understand urolithin A?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, I think that's the great thing about science, is when you can work together as a community and you have several different entities that are working on different aspects and finding out different things about how a particular compound works, that adds to the overall body of knowledge. And I think that's really one lab or one entity can't really do everything. And I think we all learn from each other. And I think that's great. It's one of the things I love about science.
And that kind of brings me to my closing question. I ask almost everyone this. Based on the science, and you are a husband and wife team working on similar subjects, because you must live and breathe this all of the time. I'm wondering how you apply the science and what you've learned over the years, over the decades, to your own life and your own longevity. Is it something that you think about?
Yeah, I think sort of the good and the bad of working someplace where you're studying aging, I think you think about it all the time. And I do think it impacts on, like, realizing that exercise or realizing that eating a healthy diet, reducing your stress level, you know, all of those things, I think it does really impact on your lifestyle. I mean, I have to admit, for fair or not, I do take a probiotic because I feel like that's a means of maintaining, along with eating healthy food and even exercise, you know, that's a way of maintaining a healthy gut and therefore I think a healthy body. So yeah, absolutely. It impacts on our day to day, lifestyle choices.
And do you think about, and you made the distinction for us between lifespan and health span, do you think about yourself in the decades to come and the kind of health span that you want to enjoy? Because I think that is the distinction, that we are enjoying life while we have good health during that window, that health span window, whereas the lifespan window may not necessarily towards the end involve good health. So I'm wondering, as you look forward, do you have aspirations?
Yes, very much so. I mean, it really, this, you know, average age of onset of Alzheimer's is 75. The sort of dogma is people may be able to live 120. Do you want to live to 120 with Alzheimer's disease? No. So everything that you can do to try to maintain your health span and healthy living is really, really important. I have to admit, I'm turning 60 this year, and I think that makes me think about it all the more as I start entering, which I guess society sort of considers being, I don't even know what it, like, more elderly state, moving towards 65. I think about it a lot. And yeah, you want to be, I hope that I can live a healthy lifespan for as long as possible. And honestly, I hope I don't develop any age-related disease. The nice thing about that is so little of that, or we've become more and more aware that so little of that is really genetic. There's some calculations that say that only 7% of our aging process is due to our genes. So there's a lot you can do in terms of environment to impact upon your health span.
Interesting. And you mentioned turning 60. I turn 60 next year. Oh. There's something about this turning point, isn't there, that certainly personally, it seems to affect you more than turning 50 or turning 40 or turning 30. Something about 60, and I haven't quite figured it out for myself. I don't know whether it's because it's so much closer to the official retirement age.
Yes, I don't know what it is either. I mean, of course, scientists like never retire. People just keep working. But even with that, I think part of what I enjoy about being a scientist is formerly, and hopefully it shall return again, we were able to travel to meetings, and I enjoyed that aspect of the job. And even after I retire, I'd like to continue traveling and reading and, I don't know, just learning as I continue to age. But yeah, it's absolutely true. There's something about 60 that is different than turning 40 or 50. And I don't really know what it is either.
Maybe we'll figure it out. Just coming back to, I mentioned in the introduction, Tony Bennett being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which really hit me because he's an extraordinary artist. He's now well into his 90s. And I think it's when we hear about famous people. Glen Campbell was another. I was lucky enough to interview Glen Campbell he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it was a remarkable day, and I could very clearly see the effects of the disease. But he then went on to perform in a world tour, and as he said to me and his wife said to me at the time, and I think the same was said about Tony Bennett, there's something about the stimulation of the brain that music can achieve that other aspects of our lives can't. But my point being that when we hear about these people that we've, I guess, lived with and grown up with and, you know, enjoyed their concerts over the years, it just brings it home to you once again, the real scourge of this disease.
Yeah, and to some extent, I mean, in the initial stages, individual is aware that they're starting to have problems. Often by the end stage, they may not be aware, but of course the family is impacted. So it not only impacts the individual, but it impacts their entire family and their community of friends and so forth. So I have a great aunt who passed away a few years ago. She lived to 97, but she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in, I don't know, like the last 10 years of her life. And you do see kind of snatches of lucidity, but it's very sad to see somebody who was so vibrant and vital succumb to this disease. It's really a horrible disorder.
It is tough. Well, Julie, thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking to
you. Yeah, well, thank you for having me. Yeah, this has been great.
Thank you so much. And if you'd like to read more about Dr. Anderson's work and more generally about the Buck Institute, I'll put some details into the show notes for this episode. You'll find them at the Live Long and Master Aging website. That's lamapodcast.com, LAMApodcast.com. And in fact, if you go to our index, search for episode 6, that's where I talk to Dr. Eric Verdin, the book's president and chief executive. It was one of our early episodes, but it's still very relevant today. This episode of the Lama Podcast was brought to you in association with Amazentis, a Swiss life science company which is pioneering cutting-edge, clinically validated cellular nutrition under its Timeline brand. The Lama Podcast is a HealthSpan media production. If you enjoy what we do, you can rate and review us at Apple Podcasts. You can follow us in social media at Lama Podcast and direct message me at Peter Bowes. Take care and many thanks for listening.